from students and faculty from the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan, as well as the many practitioners in Southeast Michigan and beyond. My name is Andrea Krauss, and I am here with my co-hosts, Jason Coleman.
Hello.
And Samuel Molnar.
Howdy.
We are all students at the School of Natural Resources and Environment, but with us as well is WCBN's Brandock. He will be doing our audio engineering today. And today we've got a whole grab bag of topics. We'll be looking at the significance behind the many headlines that you've seen about 2014 being a record-breaking warm year. We'll be looking at the School of Natural Resources and Environment's Food Olympics, which are going on today. Very exciting. And we'll be talking about Tu Bishvat.
You got it.
Yeah.
Tu Bishvat.
Which is the birthday of trees. And if you want to hear more about what that means and what that is, then you have to stay tuned in. But for now, we're going to go to a tune, and we're going to be honoring the Ann Arbor's Folk Festival, which is happening this weekend, as well as the local food summit, which will be happening next weekend. And the theme of that is love, I believe.
Food love.
Food love. So to join those two together, we are playing a bunch of artists that will be this weekend at the Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor's Folk Festival, and we'll just be playing their songs about love. So there you go. And we'll be starting off with Brandi Carlile and her cover of Can't Help Falling in Love.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't help falling in love with you. Shall I stay? Would it be if I can't help falling in love with you? Like a river flows surely to the sea, darling, so it goes. Some things are meant to be. Take my hand, take my for I can't help falling in love with you. Like a river flows surely to the sea, darling, so it goes. Some things are meant to be.
Welcome back to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. It's hot in here. This is Sam Molnar, and we're going to go over some news from the week, a little bit of Not the Onion, a little bit of This Week in Ridicule. Let's start out in Seattle, which is pretty far from here, but they're doing some interesting stuff there. You know, sometimes I throw out my coffee grounds into the garbage. What about you guys?
Who doesn't?
Yeah, my landlord actually took my compost bin away, so now that's the only thing I'm left with.
Oh, well, in Seattle, your landlord would be in big trouble.
No way.
Well, Seattle is starting to require composting to reduce food waste in their bins, and the way they're doing it is through little fines, just a dollar, but also through ridicule, embarrassment, the scarlet letter, as it's known.
What do you mean?
Well, let's say that I live in Seattle and I've got on, you know, some very tight jeans, and I throw out my coffee grinds into the garbage, and there's a man, right, Jason? There's a man who comes around?
That's how I understand it. He comes around and he actually opens the lid of the garbage can here one by one down the street, and if over 10% of what he sees is food waste, you're going to get hit.
You're going to get smacked with the Scarlet Letter.
With?
The Scarlet Letter.
What do you mean, the Scarlet Letter?
Make Nathaniel Hawthorne proud, that's for sure.
Well, you get a $1 fine, and
okay.
Then they also take a big red sticker, and they put it on your garbage can so
Ooh.
All your neighbors can tell you what a jerk you are.
Oh, no. Everybody knows that you are too lazy to put your coffee grounds into the right bin.
Yeah, but, you know, this could work better than a fine, I think, because some people might just, you know, pay it or not pay it, like a parking ticket, you know, flush it down the toilet. But
right.
Ridicule, you can't flush down the toilet.
That's true. Especially in a city like Seattle, where people are pretty environmentally conscious, and something like a big sticker telling people that you're not composting might be just enough to cast you as a social outcast, actually.
Well, and it seems for apartment building owners, for whom this is an even bigger problem, it's a $50 fine. They've one apartment building owner, in order to demonstrate to his tenants what to do, actually pulled items out of their individual garbage bins and left them on the counter of the
Whoa.
Common area in the building to show what can and cannot go in there. So that's shamed twice over.
Interesting. Well, we'll have to track whether that works, whether people will rally and... let the shame influence their actions, or whether it'll backfire, because that could happen too, right?
Yeah, you know, if we have any listeners in Seattle, you can call in at 734-763-3500, or, you know, if you're around Ann Arbor and you want to talk to us about what you think should be done with compost, you can call us in, 734-763-3500. We love your phone calls.
Exactly. And then our next piece of news in... as Sam mentioned, not The Onion, is a headline in Grist, Obama ignores Obama on climate change.
Talk about double personality.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
So I don't know if everybody tuned into the State of the Union last week. Obama had some pretty fantastic things to say, as he usually does. One of which was the fact that the Pentagon says that climate change poses immediate risk to national security and we should act to... address that. But then this week, apparently Obama himself isn't quite acting that way. His administration released a draft of its next 5-year plan for offshore drilling, and it will open up a previously off-limit area along the southeastern coast, the Gulf of Mexico, and some key areas north of Alaska, as well as some other Arctic areas. So, I mean, this is obviously a complex issue. There's a lot at stake here. But, you know, within a week, Obama went from talking at the State of the Union that, you know, he's really proud of having set aside more public lands and waters than any administration in history, to a week later opening up some areas in the Arctic for drilling.
That's really surprising, considering the drop in oil prices. You'd think that these projects... would be less economically viable than if gas was still at $4 a gallon.
That's true. It'd be really interesting to dig a little more into that as how the oil prices affect offshore drilling. Definitely with fracking, we've seen an impact in it not actually making any sense because the variable costs of those operations aren't covered anymore. But yeah, we'll have to see what happens. Hopefully... the former Obama will beat out the Obama of this week, and we'll see a stronger stance on offshore drilling.
Absolutely, and I think even further down, not to use the word pipeline here in the wrong way, but there we go. But I think we'll certainly be seeing in the next few weeks, possibly a decision handed down from the administration on the Keystone XL pipeline, which has really become a flashpoint for the environmental movement. Just this week, the House and Senate approved a bill that will be going to Obama to put this pipeline in, and he has claimed he will veto it.
That's true. He hasn't really budged from that, right?
He has not budged from that until the rest of the verdict is in from the executive branch. So keep an eye on that.
Oh, so there you have it, folks, from Scarlet Letters to dual personalities to pipelines. You got it all during this fantastic little 5-minute newsflash. And now let's go to another awesome artist that is at the Ann Arbor Folk Festival called the Yonder Mountain String Band.
I love these guys.
They are covering One Love. Well, let's go there now. WCBN Ann Arbor. We are It's Hot in Here, and today in our grab bag of environmental topics, we are talking about all sorts of things, but right now we'll be talking about the fact that 2014 was the hottest year on record. Sam, Jason, did you guys read any of those headlines? I mean, how could you not, right?
You know, yeah, I read them. I was a little confused by them. I don't really understand how it can be so hot in some places, and in Michigan, it was just so cold.
So cold.
It is very confusing, and I think, you know, in many ways, that's part of what continues to spark the ongoing debate about climate change and sort of fuels some people's insistence that maybe climate change is just a natural thing that happens. But point is, NOAA and NASA both firmly concluded that 2014 was the hottest year since record keeping began, which, FYI, began in 1880. But to dig into a little more of the significance behind that, what that means, I talked to Alexandra Brewer, who is a master's student at the School of Natural Resources and Environment. She has a background in oceanography. She's done a few projects for NOAA and really knows a lot of things about climate and public perception around it.
She's also a great juggler, I should add.
Yeah, and she sings really well. Uh-huh. I think she's a trained opera singer. Yeah,
she can sing in Finnish.
Yeah, she has a minor in Finnish. It might be the only Finnish studies minor in the world. She never ceases to impress.
Multi-talented and very knowledgeable about climate. So let's go to that interview now and listen to what Lexi has to say.
When you started reading some of the headlines about 2014 being extra warm, warmer than other years, what was your reaction? Were you at all surprised?
Maybe. I mean, yes and no. So whenever you see a headline that pulls out a year like that, it's important to keep in mind that a year does not a trend make.
Okay.
So just the fact that 2014 was the warmest year that is on record, take it or leave it. However, when you put it kind of in its context in the data series, 13 of the 15 hottest years on record have happened in the 21st century so far. So they've happened since the year 2000.
Right.
That's kind of a whammy of a statistic. And so it's more this kind of yardstick that you use to illustrate the trend.
Okay, yeah. I see.
What was interesting about this year, so it was officially deemed by NOAA 2014 was the hottest year on record. Now, you can break that down in certain different ways.
Yes.
As far as land surface temperatures, I believe it was maybe the fourth hottest. But as far as sea surface temperatures, it was the hottest. but it's more, you know, you use satellite data to keep track of this, or it's my understanding that you do.
Okay.
And it's basically you take the average terrestrial temperatures as well as the average sea surface temperatures. So the oceans are really, really good at holding in heat.
Okay.
That's why actually the degree of climate change that we've seen so far is smaller than what the initial models predicted, because so much heat was going into the oceans.
So what is the impact of that in the oceans if the temperature there is rising?
Well, if things are getting hotter in the oceans, then it's a stressor for a lot of fisheries. I'm from the Puget Sound, and there we have a really robust oyster farming.
Okay, economy. Great. Love oysters.
Oh, so. Yeah. Ocean acidification, which I'm sure you've heard of, is maybe not as much related to temperature, but more you have carbon uptake by the ocean, which then produces carbonic acid, and then you have kind of the gradual lowering of the ocean's pH as it gets more and more acidic.
So that's bad for oysters.
Yes.
Bad for fish, bad for all kinds of life forms in our oceans. Does that mean now, 2015, January, it's all falling apart in the ocean? Or what is it a more long-term impact that we have to do?
It's more of a long-term impact. Okay. And I'm not as familiar on that.
Okay.
So going back to the 2014 yardstick, you asked if it was surprising or not. And I said yes or no. So one way that it was surprising to me and to certain parts of the scientific community is that it's significant that we got this record warm year in an El Nino neutral year.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if you remember, but kind of coming into like August-ish, they were thinking, well, maybe it'll be an El Nino year. Then they realized, well, okay, probably it's like 50-50. At the end of the year, we got an El Nino neutral year. So El Nino, we're really familiar with it on the West Coast, but it's this sloshing back and forth warm waters across the Pacific, and it really affects both the temperature and precipitation patterns along kind of the West Coast of North America, but also globally. So historically, we've seen a lot of the record warm years being associated with strong El Niños, but that didn't happen last year. So that was slightly surprising. And then also, too, you know, as someone who suffered through the polar vortex in Michigan, I think it's also a good illustration that what's happening in your backyard is not what's happening globally.
Right.
So over most of the U.S., it was actually colder than average last year. We certainly felt that in the winter. But when you averaged it globally, it ended up being a really warm year.
Yeah. That definitely, there's a lot of impact to being able, in the same year, talk about the polar vortex and talk about the larger temperature trends. And then what you were saying about El Nino, when I was digging through online, it seemed like that's also something that climate skeptics sort of tend to hold on to a little more, the fact that El Nino, in their view, causes a lot of the
They like to think that we're in some weird long-term El Nino and that's what's causing everything. I think if you look at the large-scale hockey stick trend, it's pretty clear that there is an anthropogenic source for this warming.
So staying a little bit on that theme of trends and why, I mean, you are putting everything back into the context of trends, not necessarily wanting to talk about 2014 on its own, because there's not much significance just to that. So there was an article in the Times by Andrew Rufkin that was titled "How the Warmest Year Ever Headlines Can Obscure What Matters About Climate Change." And he argues also that the pattern is the key and that, again, these headlines detract from that. I know that, you know, communicating climate science, and that's definitely part of your studies and career path, not that you have the right answer to that or anything, but as you try to explain some of these concepts and thinking about, public perception around this, what do you think about that? Do you feel like headlines play an important role, like headlines being able to focus on these, like, single indicators, or they're a little negative as well?
I think they can. I think they're good for signaling awareness It's a good method to get someone to read the article saying that 2014 is the hottest year. However, if you only focus on the fact that 2014 was the hottest year outside of any other context, well, that opens you up to, if 2015 ends up being a really cold year, then someone's just going to come right back around and say that climate change isn't happening because 2015 is cold. So I think it's a good way to open the discussion. I think it's, you know, maybe not in an alarming statistic on its own, but an alarming statistic in that we keep having record years, year after record year. So I think it's a good way to open the conversation. But I wouldn't hold it up as, you know, the only source of evidence that we have anthropogenic climate change.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting that. And then just one last question. I know you went to the climate negotiations in Lima, and you've talked on a ton here about it twice. Was this mentioned at all there? Was this being cited, the fact that 2014 was probably going to end up being one of the hottest years, or
I didn't
not
notice
so much?
It. Okay. Yeah. It was kind of interesting being at the COP because science didn't really come into it that much.
Oh, okay.
I think because everyone that was there, for the most part, was already convinced of the scientific element of it.
Right.
They'd already accepted the report by the IPCC. The fact that they were negotiating was largely an indicator that climate change is something that is going to happen and is happening, and we need to try and address it. So I didn't really see the science being debated as much.
Interesting, because then I guess it just makes you think that who is the intended audience for these headlines, and you know, it's probably more likely either people on the fence that aren't really that sure whether this is actually all that important, whether climate change is something that they need to be worrying about, more so than the scientific community itself.
My guess is the scientific community sees these headlines and goes, huh, and the media sees these headlines and that's when kind of the disaster bells start ringing.
Well, thank you, Lexi.
Of course.
So there you go, guys. Lexi, one of the things she mentioned is that headlines are good for signaling awareness. It's a good way to get someone to read the article. But if you only focus on 2014 being the hottest year, you open yourself up to a whole host of potential distractions, but then also criticism, because if 2015 is then cooler, then you get some climate skeptics saying, see, aha, told you. So I don't know. What do you guys think? I mean, Jason, I know you study behavior, education, and communication. So clearly you, at some point, kind of analyze what is the best way to present some climate information or science to people. Do you think attention-grabbing headlines serve a purpose?
It's better than nothing. But it's also not particularly elegant, right? I mean, the way you put it sums up sort of these massive amounts of science into this one fact, which was 2014 was really hot. But I don't know that people hear that and walk away with anything. They don't walk away with any further understanding for why it might be the hottest. They don't walk away with any indication of what they might be able to do about it, even if it scares them.
Right.
That's always a concern for me, is that the message never leaves a walk away. It's a bit sensational and doesn't seem particularly well thought out.
I think that the way Lexi contextualized 2014 really made sense in saying that, 14 of the hottest 15 years on record have happened in the 21st century, something like that. And so I think when you put it in a context like that, that makes sense. And you can start getting people to realize that climate change isn't happening in the future, it's happening right now. And that might be a way to get people to realize that they need to invest in technology to fight climate change and adapt to it, not in 50 years, but this year.
Right, exactly. And I think part of that challenge, too, is that I think just coming to terms with that, okay, if climate change is happening now, but yet things are mostly fine in our backyard. You know what I mean? We still, at least in Michigan, we have access to plenty of clean water. The world isn't collapsing around us. So I think just the sort of duality between these doom and gloom headlines with, but my day-to-day is still unaffected, can also sort of create a lot of, it's not neutrality so much as just, you know, take it or leave it, this doesn't impact me.
I think that you know, brings in a significant communication problem. I don't know if you guys have heard of this term. It was coined out of the University of Texas in their environmental philosophy department, but the term hyperobjects.
No, what is that?
Which is most of philosophy deals with objects in the sense that we can see them or feel them, or they're ideas that we can get our minds around. Well, hyperobjects, so the story goes, are these things like climate change or the half-life of plutonium, which are events so large and experienced over time and in different ways in different places that it's very difficult for the human psyche to be able to contextualize it all or see this big idea of climate change, because it affects everybody differently and it happens over an extended period of time.
Yeah.
And that might be why these headlines could be important and could be effective, because the whole long-term climate change is a hyperobject. You can't really get your mind around what's happening. But there's a drought in California. Makes sense to me, right? And so many water mains broke in Michigan. That makes sense to me, right? So getting things into those objects might actually be helpful.
I agree with that. Showing the examples, the specific examples. Of course, here's the real challenge for scientists, which is it's incredibly difficult to prove that climate change with the capital C's is ever the cause for a small crisis.
Right. Because I think Lexi talked about how it's a stressor. Like, ultimately, it's a stressor. So if you have conditions in which, you know, your groundwater is being depleted for maybe other reasons, not necessarily directly related to whatever the temperature is, then the warmer temperatures will sort of add to it. But like you said, it's just incredibly difficult in the human brain to sort of understand how all of that overlaps and then how it extends out over time. Sam and I are working on a project related to climate adaptation, and one of the things that we keep hearing about is how sort of the natural cycles are being disturbed, and something as, because it gets warmer earlier, for example, maybe not this year. This year didn't happen so much, but because, like, you know, it gets warmer earlier in the year, certain insects, like, their natural cycle is being disturbed. And then this is what the long-term impact of that is, maybe 10 years down the line. It's just really difficult to conceptualize, but it seems like most scientists agree it is, you know, it's negative potentially to our human systems, and it's serious. So, yeah.
Absolutely. The social, the ecological, every aspect of this, the communication is always difficult. And I think that's why we're all, at least at the School of Natural Resources, working hard on it.
Yeah. Ooh. Does that mean it's time for a song?
I think so. I think we could jam out a little bit.
All right. Well, let's go to another artist at the Ann Arbor Folk Festival called Mandolin Orange. And this is their song called Oh My Love.
Oh my love, I ain't bound for this old world. I have found, and I'll find yet again. My one true love, until a new comes along, and another song my heart does sing. May bought that house next to ours. Oh, my love, I ain't bound for this old world. For I have found, and I'll find yet again. My one true love, till a new comes along, and another song my heart does sing. Another song my heart does sing.
nothing but a good time and woman. I know that the good time and push will soon reach distortion, and that's when, my dear friend, I'll go. Oh, oh, my love, I ain't bound for this old world. I have found and I'll find yet again. I want true love till a new comes along and another song my heart does sing. Count 'em, one, two, and three. He's pointing the gun at me. Half naked, scared, for death is in the air. As three bullets held out and one. Oh, my love, I ain't bound for this old world. I have found, and I'll find yet again. The song my heart can sing.
Welcome back to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. It's hot in here. Jason, you feeling hot?
Oh, so hot.
So, coming up next for you, we're going to have a little conversation about a special holiday coming up. Rhymes with hot. It's Tu B'Shvat. Ah. And this holiday is it's a Jewish holiday. It's the New Year of the Trees. It's coming up this Tuesday. And there's going to be a special event in the Dana Building. We'll fill you guys in on that at 8 p.m. to celebrate. But first, we've got Nick Bruscato, who is going to give us a little bit about the history of this holiday and what it all means. And he's going to bring you in with kind of a funky little Yiddish tune.
Ashkedi aporachat veshemesh pasorachat tipori merosh kol gag mevasrot et bohechag tu b'shvat higia chag la ilanot tu b'shvat higia chag la ilanot haaretz meshavat higia et lataat kol echad yikach lo etz ba'etim netzechotetz tu b'shvat higia chag la ilanot tu b'shvat higia chag la ilanot ashkedia porachat veshemesh pazorachat ziporim merosh kol gag mevasrot et bohechag tu b'shvat higia chag la
I'm sure a lot of you are thinking, what was that? Well, that was Hashkedia Porachat, which is probably the most popular Tu B'Shvat song. Tu B'Shvat is the festival of trees in the Jewish tradition. I'm Nick Bruscato, first-year master's student at the School of Natural Resources and Environment. And before coming to SNRE, I was an undergraduate student at the Jewish Theological Seminary, so talking about Jewish holidays is definitely in my wheelhouse. Anyways, so that song that we just heard, Hashkedia Porachat, it goes, Hashkedia Porachat Veshemesh Pazorachat Tziporim Merosh Kol Gag Mevrashot Et Bochag Tu B'Shvat Higia Chag La'ilanot Tu B'Shvat Higia Chag La'ilanot. That translates to, the almond tree is blooming and the golden sun is shining. Birds atop each roof brush the arrival of the festival. Tu B'Shvat has arrived. It's the festival of trees. Tu B'Shvat has arrived. It's the festival of trees. So, I'm sure you're like, all right, Tu B'Shvat's the Festival of Trees, but what really is Tu B'Shvat? Well, Tu B'Shvat directly translates to the 15th day of the Jewish month of Shvat. Hebrew letters in Judaism have a numerical significance, so the number that corresponds, or the word that corresponds with the number 15, is 2. So it's 15, Beshvat is in the month of Shvat. So Tu B'Shvat is this tree festival that takes place next week on February 3rd, the evening of February 3rd, on to nightfall on February 4th. And it is a new year of sorts. In Judaism, we have several new years. Rosh Hashanah, which happens in the fall, is kind of our basic new year. That's what our Jewish year is based on. And then we have Passover, which is another type of Jewish New Year, which symbolizes the liberation and exodus from Egypt, so we want to start anew. And then there's Tu B'Shvat, which is a new year for trees. So the purpose of Tu B'Shvat is to really calculate the age of trees for tithing. So for example, if you plant a tree on the 14th of Shvat, it begins its second year the next day, which would be Tu B'Shvat. But if you plant a tree 2 days later, on the 16th of Shvat, it does not reach its second year until the next Tu B'Shvat. So why is it important how old trees are? Well, in a tree's first 3 years of life, you cannot eat the fruit from it. But in that fourth year, the fruit might be ready, but that is supposed to be a tithing for God. And in that fifth year, you finally have the green light to go and eat the fruit. So there's a lot of customs that we have today. And, that can span from planting trees to eating new fruits. But usually you have a Tu B'Shvat Seder. Now, a lot of you are probably thinking, well, a Tu B'Shvat Seder, isn't Aron Seders for Passover? Well, Seders were kind of reappropriated for Tu B'Shvat in the 16th century by Kabbalists, which are these Jewish mystics in northern Israel. So they wanted a kind of a ritualized dinner to enjoy these fruits and look at the environment, but also look at the connection to God through that environment. Tu B'Shvat, although it's not mentioned in the Torah, has been around since around 200 CE, because it is mentioned in the Mishnah, which is this written down oral law code commentary that was kind of formalized in 200 CE. So it has been around for two millennia, but the exact date of the holiday's beginning isn't for sure. So anyways, these Tu B'Shvat Seders have been going on for centuries, but how are they different today? What is different about them? How do we celebrate them? I remember doing Tu B'Shvat Seders when I was little and playing that Hashgadiyah Porachat song with the terrible 1960s Israeli melody in the background and just being totally disoriented and eating a ton of dried fruits that I hated. And for some reason, I was really put off by dates, and especially carob or carob chocolate. For some reason, carob is really big on the holiday of Tu B'Shvat, which is interesting because we are kind of tasked to eat these seven species, which we call them the Shivat Haminim, which were these species that were very prevalent at the time in ancient Israel when, the Bible was canonized. And these are wheat, barley, grapes, figs, pomegranates, olives, and dates. So we eat those throughout our Tu B'Shvat Seder. But carob is not included in that, and for some reason it's always at the Tu B'Shvat Seder, maybe because it grows in Israel. But anyways, at the Seder, we say prayers and we drink wine. And obviously, I didn't drink wine when I was little, a lot of grape juice. But there is the significance of blessing these foods and enjoying them. But let's look at a more modern context for this holiday. Every year, we're engaging with the fruits of the environment, literal fruits of the environment. But this year, it's unique because Tu B'Shvat is in a Shemitah year. And I'm sure all of you listeners out there are like, another Hebrew word? I can't keep them all straight. What is Shemitah? Well, Shemitah is this sabbatical year. It's the seventh year where we let the land lay fallow. Every 7 years, we have a sabbatical year where farmers don't farm. And it's also a time where debts are forgiven, and property and borders are kind of disappear, and people have access to other people's land, and food becomes more accessible. And having Tu B'Shvat in a Shemitah year brings up a lot of great discussion topics that are very relevant and very hot right now in the environmental movement. And the environmental movement has definitely taken on this social action trend. Some people call it a socio-environmental, you know, action trend, where we can talk about sustainable farming and food access through this Jewish lens, through Tu B'Shvat and through the Shemitah year. It's great at your seders to look at where your food is coming from. When was it grown? You know, how long ago, and how do we have access to it? And these are themes and concepts and topics that we've been discussing for centuries. And I think it's wonderful that this is part of the fabric of our tradition and that we've been talking about these things for years. So if you are going to go to a Tu B'Shvat Seder on February 3rd evening, or maybe during the day on February 4th, definitely bring up these things and talk about, where is this food coming from? How did it get here? Was it grown sustainably? Who are the growers? Were they paid fair wages? And put on your advocacy hat and your environmental hat and engage in these discussions. I'm sure that this audience, obviously, you know, definitely does that and can understand that. Well, anyways, once again, I'm Nick Briscato. It's amazing to be back on It's Hot in Here on 88.3 WCBN.
All right. Thanks, Nick, for that great little rundown of Tu B'Shvat. Happy birthday to the trees.
Hey.
So if you want to go and check out your own Tu B'Shvat Seder, there's one happening this Tuesday, February 3rd, starting at 7 o'clock in the Dana Building, which is where the School of Natural Resources is. We'll be eating dates and apricots and cashews and all sorts of yummy
fruits. Can anyone
fruits.
Come?
Anyone can come.
Yes.
There might be wine.
What? In the Dana Building?
Well, you're supposed to have wine. I don't know. We might have to, you know, file a special request for that. But please come. Tuesday, February 3rd, everyone's welcome, and you can learn all about the mystical way that you can travel through the four worlds by eating dried fruit, believe it or not. And coming up next for you, going on this love theme, is a field recording from Morocco of an ancient love song, Yadid Nefesh, written by Eliezer ben Moshe Azikiri, something like that.
That was good effort.
He lived in the time when the Tu B'Shvat Seder was founded in Sfat in 1600. This field recording from Morocco is pretty different if you've heard any other recordings before. My mom used to sing this song to me when I was a little kid. It's a nice one.
Aww.
Not like they sing it in Morocco. So let's hear this.
So
Mino fe tsuf ve chole.
Welcome back to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. That was a great little recording of Yadid Nefesh from Morocco in North Africa. The title translates as Beloved of My Soul.
Sam, I have to ask, you were saying your mother sang that to you growing up, even when the beat picks up and it breaks?
That part right there. I don't know if I remember that. It was a little bit softer, I have to say.
Well, it was awesome. Thanks for sharing that song with us.
Yeah. Well, you know, beloved of my soul, food feeds my soul, food love. I think we should, you know, let people know about what's happening with food love.
Let's do it.
Next week, we will be having a special show on WCBN by Becca Baylor, one of our great hosts. And, you know, with Valentine's Day right around the corner, we're going to be hosting this show all about food love. We'll be talking about the upcoming Local Food Summit, which is happening in the Rackham Auditorium on Sunday, February 15th, which is the day after Valentine's Day.
That's true.
And this is the 7th annual Homegrown Local Food Festival.
And just to give a little plug, we have had coverage of that on the show in the past. So if you want to know what that's all about and what, just what other homegrown festivals have covered in the past, you can tune into our archives on hotinhere.us.
Mm-hmm. So you can buy your tickets to this event at localfoodsummit.org. There's also a moth story slam style.
All about food?
Avocado. Food story.
I usually make it with avocados if for a vegetarian. And I believe the name came from when soldiers went to the war, all they had to eat was potatoes and lime juice. So they say, oh, let's eat this for the cause. So the name became causa.
Great, awesome. Thanks, Alex.
You're welcome.
Excellent. So that was Team Peru. Is that correct, Pearl?
Yeah. And that salsa, I don't know how to pronounce it correctly, but it has a story.
Oh, man.
So I'm so touched by the story
Yeah. Were there a lot of people there?
Yeah, there are a lot of people. And before you enter the SNRE Commons, you can pick 3 tickets, so you can only vote for 3 different countries' food.
Oh. Is it going over the line to ask who you voted for?
Well, sure. I voted for Philippine food. I voted for Peru, and I also voted for India. And so the India team, they make... So I don't know what it's called, but it looks like a very tiny muffin, but it's all crispy. Oh. And there's a little hole inside, so they will ask you to pour a green juice into it, and you eat the whole thing all at once.
Huh. I don't know that I've ever seen such a thing.
No idea what that is. It sounds amazing.
I'm falling in love.
Okay.
With your green microphone?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
No, with the thought of that food, it sounds so delicious.
And, you know, SNRE, I think, like so many other communities around the world, loves food. And it's, I think the Food Olympics started last year, and it was just a really, really great way to display the awesome food and the awesome students that come from all over the world. And we on It's Hot in Here too, we have Pearl, who is from China.
Well, yeah, talking about that, a lot of people ask me why isn't there a Chinese team? And so our answer is that because we'll have a Chinese Spring Festival celebration on February 19th, which is a Thursday, and we'll have Chinese dumplings and some other kinds of Chinese food there. And besides food, we'll also combine it with some cultural events. There will be different activities for you to experience Chinese culture. And just for a preview, on the Friday, February 20th, we'll have It's Hot in Here show around China's.
Yay!
Sounds excellent. And where is the event going to be?
Oh, it's going to be in Dana. Right. It's also the Commons.
Yep.
Yeah.
What year are we going into? Is it the year of the sheep?
Yeah. So do you translate it into sheep or goat? I have no idea.
I think it's the sheep.
But we'll have a definite answer on that show on that Friday.
Right, so make sure that you tune in for that.
That's right. So a lot to look forward to in February. We have the Food Summit. This weekend we have the Ann Arbor Folk Festival. We'll have that awesome show on China. So yeah, folks, just keep tuning in to WCBN FM 88.3. And in case you miss our show, which comes on every Friday from noon to 1 p.m., you can always turn to our archives on hotinhere.us. So, yeah. Thank you for tuning in today.
Another week in the books.
Adios. Right. Tarjeta out.
3, 4, 5.
Hi,
the Earl of Sandwich, who invented the portable meal of two slices of bread put together with a rich, flavorful filling. But we Americans popularized the handy sandwich. And today, more Americans are carrying sandwiches than ever before in history. The fillings for good sandwiches are quite a problem these days, so I want to tell you how to make the ration points you spend for fillings do double duty. Use
WCBN
cheese spreads. With these cheese treats, you spread in rich, moist goodness and tantalizing flavor at one and the same time. Take, for example, the four
WCBN
creamy kinds. Pimento and olive pimento spreads, the zestful Roca, and
WCBN
relish spread with the chopped pickles all through it. These rich-tasting, flavorful spreads.